House Committee on Rules come to order. It's Monday, May 20, 2013. Going to open a work session on House Bill 2118. Who's coming up on that? Andrea Salinas and David Barenberg, please.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2118 comes to you from your House Healthcare Committee. The measure as written requires Oregon Health Insurance Exchange to adopt by rule additional specified criteria for certified in health plans. The Dash 3 amendment is before you today. It replaces the original member and creates a 9-member health plan quality metrics work group. It specifies the members of the work group and the conditions by which they are meeting and considering. There is a fiscal impact statement on the Dash 3. There's a no revenue impact statement on the Dash 3.
Please.
Chair Garrett, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Felisa Hagan. I'm the political director at SEIU Local 49, and I'm here today representing SEIU 503 and 49. We're in support of House Bill 2118, the Dash 3 amendments. We have a strong belief that we should do work to line up our metrics to help Oregon move forward on the path that we've been on with coordinated care organizations, as well as setting accountability in the delivery system. We also have a strong feeling that it's much more usable for providers if all the metrics across multiple lines of insurance, the more aligned we can get there, the better off that patient care delivery will be, and the better off healthcare providers will be in keeping track of what they're measuring and when it comes to outcomes. This work group is put together to help us move forward on that, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Chair Garrett, members of the committee, I'm David Barenberg, and I'm representing Cover Oregon. I agree with everything that my table mate has said, and some examples of the type of metrics that are being used are things like breast cancer screenings, the percentage of women who've had mammograms between 40 and 69, percentage of patients 50 and older who have flu shots. Those are examples of the type of metrics. Cover Oregon has adopted a set of metrics that resemble but aren't identical currently, with those being used by CCOs and others. This is to, and Cover Oregon in its metrics has been looking at, in addition to broader healthcare issues, what would help an individual or a family in choosing a plan that's appropriate for them. And what this work group will do is to try to iron out some of the differences, get some professionals together so we can better align the metrics to better have some indicators across the system of how it works, and for providers that they are not having to provide multiple sets of information, but can really just provide a similar sets of reporting to multiple entities to really simplify the process. So Cover Oregon supports this amendment, and I'm happy to answer any questions the committee may have.
Any questions? Representative Kettlemore.
Help me with this. I guess my sense is we're setting up an enormous number of work groups and things to review, and it just seems that in my little frame this is duplicative. I'd like a response to that.
Chair Garrett, Representative Kinnemer, our hope is actually to reduce duplication by setting this up. So I think what's currently working is PEB is working, will be working on a set of metrics regarding their request for proposals. OWEB will be working on a set of metrics regarding their request for proposals. CCOs have a set of metrics. And so, and as Mr. Barenberg stated, they also have a set of metrics. So if we could actually get a group together and come up with, you know, a similar set, our hope is to reduce duplication and duplication of efforts in this so that we can actually have a sort of a statewide base and coming out of that. And so I think, as Mr. Barenberg stated, you know, if we're going to set a metric for, let's say, the exchange population, the Cover Oregon population of adults over 35 receiving a flu shot, and the same metric for PEB, and the same metric for OWEB, and the same metric for, like, those groups should talk together so that providers are clear that across insurance lines that they can be doing that. A healthcare provider, we've heard from a lot of them, have said when they're treating a patient, they don't look at their insurance and say, what should I be measuring? based on your insurance. They say, what should I be measuring based on this person? And so our hope is to reduce that duplication.
And Chair Garrett, Representative Kinnamer, if you see that this work group is very limited in duration, it will report, have an interim report back to the February 14 session, but is intended to complete its work and go away after May of 14. So it's a very focused, short-term attempt to try to bring some more alignment and efficiency into the system.
Yeah, thank you. And under whose direction will this be then?
What was the question?
The question is, under whose direction is this then?
Chair Garrett, Representative Kinnamer, it is OHA and Cover Oregon working together. I think it says Cover Oregon in consultation with OHA, and since OHA is the parent of OEB and PEB, you know, it's fairly limited, and as you see, it has a few technical experts plus a carrier representative and then a public representative just to bring in some expertise and make sure all the players are coordinated. In addition, a self-insured large employer.
Mr. Chairman, just a question. Is OHA going to testify about this bill?
Not to my knowledge. No, they have not requested to testify.
Chair Garrett, Representative Kinnamer, we have been in consultation with OHA and understand that they're fine with this set of amendments.
Further discussion? We're in work session.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 3 amendment to House Bill 2118.
Representative Hoyle moves the Dash 3 amendment to House Bill 2118. Is there a discussion on the motion? Is there objection? Hearing none, motion carries.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there is a fiscal impact. It is indeterminate. We have been asked to refer this down to Ways and Means, so there is not currently a subsequent referral, so we will be adding one from this committee.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2118 as amended without recommendation as to passage and the measure be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Vice Chair Hoyle moves House Bill 2118 as amended without recommendation as to passage and the measure be referred to Committee on Ways and Means. Is there a discussion? Representative Berger.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I am concerned anytime a task force gets formed with an indeterminate, and it sounds like a lot of people are working on this. I am, shall we say, not convinced that this is a necessary work group, so I will be opposing them.
Further discussion?
I guess I think it's redundant, and OHA should have the authority to do what they need to do.
Okay, let's have a roll call vote on the motion, please.
Representative Barnhart.
Aye.
Representative Berger.
No.
Representative Denbrough.
Yes.
Representative Colby.
Aye.
Representative Jensen.
Aye.
Representative Kinnamer.
No.
Vice Chair Hoyle.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hicks.
No.
Chair Garrett.
Aye. Motion carries. Those referred. Close the work session on House Bill 2118. And we're going to recess for just a minute.
Recess.
I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3516, and we'll first hear from, we have Senator Johnson, also Representative Fagan, and Representative Reardon in the room. Well, we have Representative Fagan in the room. Senator Johnson, would you like to identify yourself and start off with your testimony?
Thank you very much, and I appreciate your courtesy in allowing me to appear this way. I was in the Capitol today, and I'm headed back to the rehabilitation facility for more physical therapy this afternoon. So thank you for your courtesy. For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I represent Senate District 16. It is a little odd that I would have an interest in the issue out in Clackamas County and an issue out there, but the my interest arises from personal relationships that I have with some of the businesses that are affected by one of the Johnson Transportation projects, the Sunrise Corridor. I have worked very closely with Senator Johnson and Senator Olson on this issue, and I think that they are going to be in the room and able to offer their testimony as well. So I'll be very brief. At the time that I became privy to this discussion, ODOT had been representing to the community that an overpass called Tolbert was part of the whole package to mitigate disruption caused by closing a rail crossing at the intersection of Lawnfield and the Lawnfield Road and the rail crossing. And I arrived at this late. I had not been party to any of the public outreach. I know ODOT does public outreach with their projects. Sometimes it's a little bit episodic rather than seeing the entire project laid out. But it was my understanding from talking to the affected businesses that they had been led to believe right straight along that the Tolbert crossing would be part of the whole package. And they had grudgingly agreed, given that it was going to disrupt business to a well-established business park. And as time progressed, ODOT moved forward with the rail crossing, but not with Tolbert. I'm told that Tolbert is on a Department of Defense funding list because it will serve Camp Withicum, but somehow Tolbert dropped off, the construction dropped off of ODOT's plan, and it would come as no great surprise to anybody that the plan as presented, when it became not the plan that was going to be built, the businesses were really quite upset about it. So now we have moved forward with a lot of negotiations and a lot of discussions and, frankly, a lawsuit, and it appears that ODOT is now willing to fund at Tolbert, but there is going to be a lengthy delay. It also appears that ODOT may be holding funding for the Tolbert construction hostage until the local citizens drop their lawsuits. And I would just have to say that as a legislator and as a citizen of Oregon, I find that tactic repugnant, and so I just hold that up as a flag. This bill requires that Tolbert be built to service this well-established business community that has been in existence since the 80s. The Dash 2 amendments require ODOT not to close the rail crossing at Lawnfield until Tolbert is open, and I believe, and this is why I'm lending my support to the bill, that this is only fair in light of how poorly local citizens have been treated during the discussion of this very significant, and I would add, badly needed project. I don't think anybody is trying to disrupt the project given the level of congestion in this area and the large distribution centers that are serviced by the proposed construction. It's just a matter of treating established businesses fairly and getting a public process that actually delivers what the citizens expected. So I'm sure that there are others in the room that can add more. I know it's annoying to have me testifying with all this background noise. I appreciate the courtesy of an opportunity to appear on behalf of 3516, and I hope the committee gives it serious consideration and moves the bill forward with the Dash 2 amendment. Thank you very much, and I take any questions.
Senator Johnson, first of all, I want to thank you very much for agreeing to testify, and we're glad to have you hear your testimony in any way we can, although we very much look forward to seeing you back in the building. Anyone have questions on the committee?
The Dash 2 or 3?
Representative Holvey.
Uh,
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a clarification, I'm looking at a dash 3 amendment in OLIS, and Senator Johnson is talking of a dash 2, so I hope she's aware of a dash 3, and if she isn't, maybe she needs to look at it so she can weigh in on that one. We do have a dash 2. It got handed to me just as we speak, so maybe I'm the one that's confused.
And members of the committee.
Madam Chair and Representative Holby, I believe that there are dash 2s and for subsequent late arrival dash 3. I am advocating on behalf of the dash 2.
Great. Thank you very much. Senator Johnson. Any other questions from the committee? Well, thank you for your testimony. You're welcome to stay on and listen or not.
Given the level of background noise and the disruption of the committee, I'm going to ring off. Again, I appreciate your courtesy, and I hope I'll see you all around campus in the coming week.
Thank you very much. Okay, next we'll hear from Representative Fagan. Please identify yourself for the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Vice Chair Hicks, members of the committee. For the record, Shamia Fagan, State Rep for House District 51. I'm going to back up a little bit because I'm the author of the original bill, and I'm aware of what was the dash 1s and the dash 3s. I learned about the dash 2s about 15 minutes ago. And so we haven't really had a chance to, and I think now there's a copy of them flying around. It's my understanding that the dash 2s, which I haven't had a chance to really review yet, deal with the timing, which is a separate issue than I was dealing with originally in the bill. So I'm just going to back up really quickly. The Sunrise Corridor project is a project that was funded in the 2009 Jobs and Transportation Act. The lawsuit that arose that Senator Johnson referred to from the businesses in the Lawnfield area, and I was approached earlier this year from folks in ODOT and Clackamas County saying, great news, the bids for the project came in underbid significantly. And so we actually think that we have funds now to build the Tolbert overpass, which should help to appease some of the businesses that are going to be disrupted from the new Sunrise Corridor. So they said, they asked me to advocate through the Ways and Means process that funding is protected. I approached Representative Buckley to find out, as a new legislator, what's the best way to protect this funding? Is it at risk? And he essentially said that money will come back looking like savings, and that in the flurry of the June budgets, I guess things get a little crazy around here in June. I have yet to experience that yet. But he said in the flurry of crazy budgets in June that money certainly could be seen as savings and applied somewhere else. And so out of an abundance of caution, I drafted a very simple bill essentially saying, no, that money should not go elsewhere. In fact, my bill was drafted early on, I think actually the best embodiment of the true heart of this bill is in subsection 4 of the dash 3s, which just basically says the amount allocated to the Sunrise Corridor project by section blah blah shall be used to complete the Sunrise project, including the Tolbert Street improvements, before being reallocated to any other project. The dash 3s were under my authority from ODOT. It looks like it's getting a little bit controversial. There's some attempts to codify certain timing things. So I kind of want to pull back to the heart of the bill, which I have yet to speak with the folks who are proposing the dash 2s. But I believe, at least from everyone that I've spoken to, that it would be not controversial to do essentially a dash 4 that embodies merely subsection 4 of the dash 3s. Man, this is a lot of numbers. Just essentially saying from the state level, we're not going to put that money anywhere else, because that was my original intent with bringing this bill forward. Attempting to codify different time frames wasn't my original intent. Those are things I certainly think can be worked out at the local level between the groups that are negotiating. My intent with this bill was simply to make sure that in the flurry of June in the Ways and Means process, this money does not get taken from this Sunrise project and put elsewhere, but that it is saved for funding this Tolbert overpass. So that's kind of the heart of the bill. Like I said, the amendments, the dash 1 and the dash 3 were under my authority. The dash 2 I'm learning about, but the true heart of the bill is to make sure that this money is not reallocated to any other project.
Okay, next we'll hear from Representative Reardon.
And Madam Chair, Committee, I really cannot add anything to what Representative...
Please identify yourself for the record.
Sorry. Jeff Reardon, District 48, which includes part of Clackamas County, and that's my reason for being here, just primarily to indicate that this is extremely important project to the development and ongoing viability of that industrial area. So the facts are stated very well by Representative Fagan, and I will be here to support her. So.
Great. Senator Olson?
Thank you very much. My name is Alan Olson. I represent Senate District 20, which is the heart of Clackamas County, and this project is right at the very uppermost edge of my district. I'm here to support the Dash 2 amendment. I've been working with the folks in the Lawnfield District now for many, many months, since I guess about the middle of last year, and their concern has always been the lack of openness with ODOT to start with, but secondly, the opportunity to use the Lawnfield intersection so that they could get to Interstate 205. It's a very busy industrial area, has many trucks going in and day out. It's important that as this project goes forward, which it should because it is a good project and it will help the traffic in the area, but it's important as this project goes forward that these folks have the access to the transportation that they need while this project goes on. And that would mean keeping the Lawnfield railroad crossing open until the Tolbert Bridge is built. It's incumbent upon us as legislatures to make certain that these industries that create jobs and that bring people in and bring dollars into our communities are sufficiently protected so that their businesses will not be hurt, so that they don't have a downfall in their income, and so that they don't lay off people. If on some handout that I passed out there, you'll see some blue lines that go up, or a grade improvement project, that's a 17% grade. And that's very difficult for semis to get up and down on. And so the easiest and the most productive access is over the Lawnfield rail track area. And that gets them to 205 north and south very easily. If that unit is closed off while construction takes place, you can follow the blue lines, take it all the way down to 224. You can see the difficulty they'll have moving their merchandise in and out and getting their customers in and out. So I think it's incumbent upon us to make certain that although this is a great project and the bill is important that we're talking about, to make certain that the Tolbert overpass is built, I think it's incumbent upon us to make certain that the rail crossing stays open and available to these folks while that bridge is being built, so that they do not suffer financial harm. And I will take any questions.
Questions from the committee? Representative Berger.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Fagan, your original bill speaks to a shared concern that I have for my favorite project, which is the Newburgh-Dundee bypass. And I just want to put on the record that there is this issue of if money is to be saved in the project, there's a lot more to the project that could be done. And I think you articulated very well that in the case here, you want to keep the money with the project. And so those other things can be done. And I have a very similar issue with the Newburgh-Dundee project, which is also part of this package. So I appreciate your comments because I share them.
Any other questions from the committee? Representative Dembrough.
So the Dash 2 and the Dash 3, do you see them as mutually exclusive, or can they work together? I'm not totally clear on the competing visions.
Chair Hoyle, Representative Dembrough, like I said, I just saw the Dash 2 amendment, so at first glance, they appear contradictory because parts of the Dash 3 indicate certain timelines. But again, the heart of the purpose of this bill is to make sure the funding is protected. Things about when things are built and timing could be worked out at a lower level. So for me, the most important piece could potentially be embodied in a Dash 4. Just essentially, I think it's worded in my original bill, is probably just not worded as well as a section of the Dash 3 is. I think that, at least on that part, I believe everyone's in agreement, is that this funding should be protected. And considering that that's the real concern for the state is the fear that that funding will get swept elsewhere. That's my most important piece that it get pushed forward. But I believe there's other folks who are going to testify who might be able to speak better on the details of the dash three and the dash four. I would only ask that if that ends up in a controversy that the bill can't move forward, that we just drop it down to the protection of the funding, because that part, I think, everybody agrees on, and that part does need to move forward, as opposed to getting mired in controversy over different timelines that can be worked out at a local level.
Chairwell, Representative Dembrough, I unfortunately hadn't seen the dash three and knew of the dash two. My concern is partially due to fire life safety. And I think we can work these things together. But the fact is that if you look at the drawing I gave you, the fire station is on the west side of the railroad tracks, and you can see Lawnfield is on the east side. Now, the fire station now can go up 82nd, come across Lawnfield, and be quickly into the Lawnfield area. Without the Tolbert overpass, if you look at your map, they have to go down to 224, back up, and loop around and make this great big loop to get back into the thing. So I'm looking at not only the expediency of the Tolbert overpass, but the fact that if the Lawnfield rail crossing was kept open, we would make certain that the fire life safety was intact while the construction project was going on. And then after Tolbert is built, you can see that that shortens that distance up considerably for them to get back into the Lawnfield area. So I think this is a mutually exclusive thing where we can work these details together, but make sure that the funding stays available, but still keep Lawnfield open until we have protections for anything that could be injurious to the groups in the industrial park.
Thank you. Any other comments from the panel or questions from the committee? I'm going to take that as a no, and thank you very much. And we'll call up Matt Garrett from ODOT and Cam Gilmore from Clackamas County. Mr. Garrett.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. I am Matthew Garrett. I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Transportation. It's my pleasure to be here. I'd like to speak to four points specific to the dash threes, and then as I just had received the dash twos 20 minutes or so ago, I'll speak to that, but it'll be a quick cursory comment here. But first, 4 points. The first point being the bill, the Dash 3 amendments would have ODOT prioritize Tolbert Street improvements as the next component or element of the Sunrise Corridor project. Again, the overall project for the Sunrise is about $1 billion project here. JTA investment of $100 million coupled with investments coming from Clackamas County, coming from the region, coming from the state, allowed us to make an investment for this first phase here. But again, it's a much bigger project here. So again, the first element here is a sequential type issue. Queue up Tolbert after you move that mainline investment. And that mainline investment was just awarded to an Oregon firm, Kerr Construction of Woodburn, to break ground this summer construction season. In addition to the mainline, which connects really 205 to 122nd, there will be, as was suggested, work done on Lawnfield. As the Senator spoke, right now it is a significant incline. It's 17% to 18%. The work to be done with this investment that hits the ground this summer construction season drops that grade down to 8%. In addition to it, there is another access point, Industrial Way, that will connect up Lawnfield Road to 212, 224. Really about 0.8 miles in addition to where a Tolbert crossing would be. So there is a timing issue in terms of how we sequence this. But again, I want you to know this specific issue, we as an agency are comfortable with this direction. The second issue is the Dash 3s would have us enter into an intergovernmental agreement with our partners at Clackamas County for the design and construction of the Tolbert Street improvements. We certainly are comfortable with this direction, as we have already executed a design IGA with Clackamas County. So we've actually put money on the table for them to begin that work, and I think they probably hit the streets within the week or so for a request for a proposal here. So we're moving and leaning forward there. So obviously we're very comfortable with that direction as we have executed that piece of it. And then again, sequentially, construction would come after we have the design work done. The third point I'd like to speak to would be the bill would have any savings, and this was the piece that Representative Fagan spoke to, any savings from the JTA marked project on the Sunset Corridor shall stay with the project and shall be used to construct additional improvements, including the Tolbert crossing here. So we are comfortable with that piece of direction as well. And finally, the fourth point being, and another sequencing type issue here, is the construction funds are to be released for the Tolbert crossing only if the at-grade railroad crossing at Southeast Longfield Road is closed. We would concur with that direction, and that gets me to the dash twos that we have spoke to. As I look at it, for all intents and purposes, the language included in the dash twos are what's being litigated, whether it's in front of an administrative law judge in terms of the rail crossing closure discussions that we are engaged in as we speak with a adjudication time frame coming after a July 15th date when the hearing is to transpire. So we're moving back and forth with the paperwork, so to speak, on the rail crossing. And in addition to that, there has been a case dropped in Clackamas County Circuit Court, a case to summary judgment to stop the project here. And again, that is a conversation that's playing itself as we speak, and we shall see how that turns out. So I would be very concerned in terms of the timing associated with the dash twos, because what it would demand is we stand down from awarding that initial Jobs and Transportation Act project, that $130 million some dollar project, in order for us to wait till we do the design work, which would, even in the most expeditious manner, and I think ODOT and Clackamas County are working very quickly to make sure that the county is moving judiciously, as we have put the money on the table and they're now moving it, so we'd like to move very quickly. But we think we would lose a year at least in the construction season here. I think given the project has been awarded, given that it is paychecks in people's hands and we're moving a significant project that was part of the Jobs and Transportation Act, I would have real concerns with the dash twos, because I think it compromises the benefit that will come as we move that mainline project. And again, we often don't speak about that, but let me remind you that when done, the investment in this Sunrise Corridor Phase 1 project removes just about 1 million hours of delay for the good folks who are traveling 205, 212, and 224 here. So there is some inconvenience, there is no question. We realize that from the good folks who make up that lawn field business area. But again, the project does keep two access points open, an improved lawn field access, as well as that industrial way. And what we're talking about is a difference of 0.8 of a mile, or roughly, if you time it, about 3 minutes. So it is an inconvenience, there is no question, but it's a short-term inconvenience. We believe if all falls into place and that rail crossing is closed because of safety and operational issues that the Union Pacific has, as we start to fly over, we believe there'll be a time frame of about a year or so, maybe just a little less, but about a year to be conservative, in terms of the time that we close Lawnfield and we would open up the overcrossing at Tolbert here. So it is an inconvenience, there's no question about it, but realize we're talking about 0.8 of a mile, or about 3 minutes, that if you take that access points, because there are two other access points out of the industrial area there. So with that, Madam Chair, I'm happy to answer any questions.
So do you know how many people would be employed by this project? How many jobs would be delayed for that year?
So, Madam Chairman, I can't tell you off the top of my head, but there is an industry-accepted formula that for every $1 million invested in transportation infrastructure construction yields about 12 million. I'm rounding up just a little bit, but yields about 12 jobs, family-wide jobs, per $1 million of investment. So if you just start to do the math, you can see. And I won't do the math at this table because I'd get it wrong and embarrass myself, but you can do the math and you can see there's a significant amount of boots on the ground that'll be employed. And again, I do remind folks that it is the Oregon firm Kerr Construction of Woodburn that secured the low bid for the project.
All right, questions from the committee?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Director Garrett, I'm just looking at the dash two and seeing that it, you know, just to trace back a second, that it basically says you can't close the at-grade rail crossing, and I guess from your testimony as far as the timing and the sequencing of the project that's currently underway, the current project will be anticipating closing that rail crossing to get the construction done.
That's correct. Madam Chair, Representative Holvey, that is exactly right. This is an issue of safety and operations. The Union Pacific runs their trains. We're flying over it with the investment we're making. With the Sunrise project, we would close that down to make sure we haven't compromised the safety or operations of the railroad or putting anyone in harm's way there. So it is an issue of timing and safety.
Follow up. And so I would imagine that in the planning process, the engineers and everybody tried to figure out a way to keep that closing open during construction, but determined that it wasn't the most expedient thing to do?
Madam Chair, Representative Holloway, I appreciate the question. I will tell you we have done everything we can to accommodate the folks in the business center. We actually looked at pushing back the opening of Lawnfield as far as possible. And we also looked at additional crossings at Clackamas, just a little further south of the Tolbert crossing here. But again, because of operational and safety issues, that didn't become prudent. So what we tried to do was accommodate the concerns expressed by the businesses. That was not lost on us. But when all was said and done, it became, again, a safety and operational type issues. And then it became a timing in terms of putting this investment on the ground as we speak and then realizing the benefit that comes from the investment here. So we did everything we could. We worked with these folks. We just could not find accommodation. We thought it prudent to close Lawnfield, which was always part of the conversation. If you go back for the time that we have been engaged in the project, whether it was in the environmental process or subsequent or supplemental environmental processes. The closing of the Lawnfield rail at-grade rail crossing was always a component in there.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you. So, Mr. Gilmore.
Chair Garrett, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Cam Gilmore, and I am Director of Transportation and Development for Clackamas County. My purpose here today is to speak on behalf of the Clackamas County Board of Commissioners, who are in full support of House Bill 3516, and that would be the bill that Representative Fagan addressed without the most recently submitted amendment, I believe, which was called Dash 2.
Dash 2.
My remarks are really very brief. Last week, the Board of Commissioners executed an IGA with the Oregon Department of Transportation that Mr. Garrett just mentioned. That was Thursday night. We're anticipating getting a request for proposal out for design services shortly, within a week or two. And hopefully we'll have a design consultant on board sometime this summer. Our goal, like ODOT's, is to ensure that the time frame for completing Tolbert is as short as possible. And this is a key event last week in that the clock is now running, and we're very hopeful to have something to construction. I can't specify an exact time at this point, but sometime late next summer, I hope. And as Mr. Garrett said, hopefully the difference between the opening of the Sunrise and the closure and the opening of Tolbert is within a year's time or so at this point. We're going to use every shred of insight and knowledge we have to ensure this design process is quick. We're going to probably look at some alternative methods like design build, what have you, anything to knock time off, because certainly we recognize the importance to the business community there, who we've been working with for a number of years to ensure that whatever disruption there is kept to a minimum. But say this, the Lawnfield reconstruction that Director Garrett spoke to is underway, and we hope to have it done this fall. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Yes.
Thank you. Do I gather, so this point of the project described in the Dash 2 amendments, the Lawnfield and railroad crossing, do I gather that is scheduled to be completed this fall? How long would the crossing be closed?
Madam Chair and Representative Hicks, what I'm talking about is the other side of Lawn Field. It's the portion of Lawn Field that actually has access to 97th, not 82nd Drive. And it's a key component for mitigation of construction impacts actually associated with the Sunrise Project, because that will afford businesses with another access they don't have today because of the steep grade that exists. I think Director Garrett mentioned a 17% grade that exists today, and it's sort of a serpentine road that goes up with hardly any landing for long trucks. The new design reduces that to about 8.4%, the grade to about 8.4%, widens the road slightly, puts a little different super on it, has good turning radii at both ends, and a platform for the trucks at the top.
Yes, follow up.
How long will the railroad crossing be closed?
It's permanent.
Oh, thank you.
All right. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And
thank
you. I'll call up my next panel, John DiLorenzo, Elizabeth Galuto, and Mark Lennon. Lennon? You can tell me how to pronounce your name, and I'll...
Lennon.
Thank you. Mr. DiLorenzo, why don't you start?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the House Rules Committee. For the record, my name is John DiLorenzo. I'm a partner at the law firm of Davis Wright Tremaine, and I'm here on behalf of my clients, the Lawn Field Industrial Owners Association. With me is Elizabeth Gallardo of Utility Trailer, Inc., and Mark Lanoux, who is the managing partner of the Clackamas Commerce Center. They are officers also of the association. We are here today in support of the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 3516. Madam Chair, we represent over 25 businesses who are reliant on the Lawn Field Road grade railroad crossing to remain open so their businesses can have continued access to Southeast 82nd Drive. The Sunrise Project, which Mr. Garrett, Director Garrett, spoke to moments ago, plans to close that railroad crossing. My representation of this group began last year when I learned from my clients that ODOT had reneged on its commitment to the community to build the overpass at Tolbert Road to connect its area to 82nd while the railroad crossing was closed. That alternative access, Tolbert, was promised during open houses conducted by ODOT. It was specifically promised and noted in the federal environmental impact statement with respect to the project, and it was specified particularly in what's called the IAMP, which is the Interchange Access Management Plan. My clients begrudgingly accepted this plan to close the railroad crossing in reliance on that alternative access being opened for Tolbert Road. Little did they know that ODOT had pared back the project, intending to build what would isolate them from needed services, to close the rail crossing, not because of safety issues, but because of a trade with the Union Pacific Railroad for permission to build over its tracks, and then fail to pursue the Tolbert overpass. In other words, this was promised as a package deal, and all of a sudden ODOT decided to only build part of the package. Now, last summer and fall, Senator Johnson and Senator Olson came to our defense and helped us navigate through this process by arranging and participating in a number of conversations with ODOT. We thought we had a deal in August, but ODOT withdrew when the railroad balked at the idea. Last month, we filed a lawsuit seeking to restrain ODOT from closing the rail crossing until Tolbert was opened as provided in the IAMP. Now, ODOT regards this Interchange Access Management Plan as an aspirational document. We regard it as a land use regulation. The reason we regard it as a land use regulation is because Clackamas County has incorporated it into Clackamas County's comprehensive plan. And so, with respect to the IAMP, we think it's a land use regulation. We think the circuit court has authority to enforce land use regulations. And we think by violating the IAMP, ODOT is violating the comprehensive plan of the county. Now, when this process began, I attributed our differences to merely disagreements on policy and the law. But it was not until I had an opportunity to review thousands of pages of public records requests that I came to understand the full depth of the disregard that ODOT staff has had for my clients and for their concerns. We've provided you a little packet, and they are some emails. And in the lower right-hand corner, they have my not-so-artful page numbers, which I'd like to refer you to very briefly. If you turn to page 2, you will find emails from ODOT that make it clear how this project really works. First of all, ODOT cannot build the Sunrise Project without an easement from the railroad going over the tracks and what's called a construction and management agreement. They did not have the easement at the time these emails were written, nor do they have them today. They have bid out this project for over $50 million, and they still do not have an easement from the railroad. Why? The Union Pacific Railroad will not give them an easement until the crossing is closed. It has nothing to do with safety. It has to do with a deal with the railroad. But we do not believe that the IAMP allows the crossing to be closed until such time as Tolbert is constructed. And therein lies the problem. Until such time as the lawsuit is resolved, and my discussions with the railroad's attorney suggest that is after all appeals have been expired, the railroad is not of a mind to give ODOT an easement. And without an easement, ODOT can't build anything. That is why the Dash 2 amendments will expedite the construction of this project and not delay it. If you're so kind as to turn to page 4, you'll see an email from Mr. Winsheimer, dated November 14, 2011, in which he talks about my client's concerns. He says that the concern for opening the Tolbert overcrossing was so, quote, people could go to 82nd Avenue for lunch, unquote. He then says that the Longfield group believes that Tolbert is a must-have, that they were promised the Tolbert overcrossing. But then ODOT determines that, oh, that promise was in the FEIS, the Final Environmental Impact Statement build, not the JTA build. And so he says, well, the promise was made in the Federal Environmental Impact Statement, but not in what we want to do now. He says, we explained that we were not building that full project today and that Tolbert was still being developed for later. If you turn to page 6, you'll find an email that shows how the staff at ODOT has felt about the Tolbert overpass. It says, quote, internally, this is being described as $22 million for a latte. If you turn to page 9, you will see a discussion about how this whole Tolbert overpass is becoming highly political. At page 11, how Senator Johnson is fixated on Longfield. And at page 13, the quote from ODOT staff, I don't think we have it, referring to information about Tolbert. This is August 7th, 2012. Quote, it was always the $28 million element we couldn't afford to add to the JTA project. In other words, ODOT knew that they weren't going to ever be able to afford this for phase one, notwithstanding the promises that they made to my clients. Page 17 is the most troubling of all. And as I stated earlier, during July and August, we were involved in a series of what we thought were problem-solving discussions with ODOT. Senator Johnson and Senator Olson and others were very much involved. ODOT characterizes those discussions as, quote, a tactical pause in submitting the crossing order application, unquote. Well, Madam Chair, for these reasons, we have no real trust that ODOT will perform as they are now suggesting to the county. Importantly, the county planners have been told that they cannot have their, they can have their money for Tolbert design, but they can't have their money for construction until my clients dismissed their lawsuit. In other words, ODOT is holding their construction funds, as Senator Johnson mentioned, hostage until we drop the lawsuit. Now, I don't like playing that way, and I will not leave my clients defenseless in light of this record. The Dash 2 amendment solves this problem for us. Yes, it does create some problems for ODOT, but those are problems of ODOT's own making. They are the ones who departed from their own policies requiring that their I's be dotted and their T's be crossed before they let out a contract. But they do not even have an easement. And who in the world would obligate themselves for this kind of money without knowing that they can build over the tracks? If this passes as amended, there will be a resolution to the overall problem. It may be delayed, but it will be resolved. Madam Chair, unless you have questions for me right now, I would like to now turn this over to Ms. Gallardo.
There are just a couple. I have one question. Representative has a question. Just to process, so I'm assuming that you worked with someone to put forward the Dash 2 amendments.
Yes.
Did you notify either of the co-sponsors of the bill before you decided to amend their bill?
Yes. In fact, I just apologized to Representative Fagan. I was working with Representative Barton on this, and over a week ago, I talked with him first 2 weeks ago, and then over a week ago, I told him that I was going to submit a Dash 2 amendment. I described what it did. He told me he didn't have any problem with it. I'm sorry. I worked with him. I should have also called Representative
the other
Fagan.
Chief co-sponsors of the bill who have worked, I think, diligently and in good faith to move something forward. This changes that bill considerably.
Madam Chair, I understand that. Again, I did apologize to Representative Fagan. I made an appointment to go see her to talk more about this. I understood that we're not having a work session
today. We are not having a work session.
Right. So there is time to do that. And again, I thought when I talked with Representative Barton about it, that had been communicated, and that was my mistake. That had not been communicated.
Right. Representative Hicks.
What relief does your lawsuit seek?
Madam Chair, Representative Hicks, the lawsuit is for injunctive relief. It doesn't command ODOT to do anything. It says do not close the railroad crossing until Tolbert is constructed. They can do nothing. That's fine, too. But it just says you are not allowed to close the railroad crossing until Tolbert is available.
Okay. Well, yourself. Please identify yourself for the record, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. I'm Elizabeth Gallardo with Utility Trailer Sales of Oregon. My family's owned utility trailer in Oregon, in Clackamas, for 29 years. We're a full-service semi-trailer dealership. We sell new and used 48-foot to 53-foot refrigerated, dry, and flatbed semi-trailers, aftermarket parts, and we repair trailers at our facility. We proudly employ 30 people and are experiencing a growth with the recent economic improvements. I'm here today to express our support of House Bill 3516 regarding the construction of Sunrise Corridor in Clackamas, and more specifically the Dash 2 Amendment addressing the timing of the building of the Tolbert Overpass. Our business happens to be located in a position that will be hindered by the construction of the Sunrise Corridor. We're losing our current access to I-205, which is a main truck thoroughfare, and given that we deal exclusively with the trucking industry, the Sunrise is putting us at a competitive disadvantage. We operate in a very competitive industry. Our customers have many options for trailer parts and service in the Portland area, and we attribute some of our success to our geographic location and the ease of access. All that will change with the construction of the Sunrise. But some of this less than desirable access modification will be mitigated by the construction of the Tolbert Overpass. While we still won't have our current access to 205, the overpass will allow for an acceptable alternative access to 82nd Drive. It's an important route for us to get to necessary services and, more importantly, for customers to get to us. We are delighted that ODOT and Clackamas County are in the process of negotiating the necessary contracts to build Tolbert, but we are concerned about the timing of the overpass opening versus when our existing access to 82nd will be closed for construction. We're a business that's heavily reliant on drive-up and walk-in customers and vendors. Given this, the anticipated 2+ years of construction of the Sunrise Corridor is going to be wildly disruptive to our normal course of business. We're very concerned about how we might be able to continue our level of business if our customers do not have easy access to our facility. And it seems a little counterintuitive that the project is funded with the intent to generate employment. However, we're an existing employer who may not be able to maintain existing staffing levels because of the project. And while we've been told that Tolbert will be built, we recently learned that the lag in time between Tolbert opening and our existing Lawnfield Road being closed could be as much as 2 years. We ask, how can we continue to operate our business without the ingress and egress that we've been promised by ODOT? As a demonstration of the disruption that this causes to our business and to our neighbors' businesses, I prepared the map that I believe you all have as a handout. While ODOT is arguing that we're only talking about a temporary detour, I think Mr. Garrett referenced a 0.8 mile, but I actually clocked it's a mile and a half. We have repeatedly driven this new route, which is represented by the larger dash line, and it takes an average time during rush hour of 13 minutes from our business, which is at point A at the top of the map, to point B, which is over on 82nd Drive. So the current access takes a little bit between a minute to a minute and a half. So we're going from minute and a half to 13 minutes because of this detour. So I asked, why would my customers want to drive an additional 13 minutes to get to my facility when our competitors' locations are more direct and less complicated to get to? So we've come to you in support of the amendment that ensures that Tolbert Overpass be constructed and functional prior to closing our existing access at Lawnfield Road is critical to our business's success.
Any questions?
Yourself, sir.
Good afternoon. My name's Mark Lanoux. I'm a landowner in the Lawnfield Basin. I'm one of approximately 50 landowners in that basin. 50 owners, probably near 100 different companies, and well into the thousands the number of people that work in the Lawnfield Basin. And this is extremely important to us. This does not include the daily traffic that comes into the basin for services to our businesses and or to pick up products that are being sold by the industrial users, the industrial land users in that area. A lot of this might seem a little redundant, but what happens here, and the question is, you know, how do we get people to our businesses? And there are maps that you all have, but right now the 90%+ of the people that come to all of our businesses come in off of Lawnfield Road at the railroad crossing at Southeast 82nd Drive. This is one block down to the heart of our industrial section. And what do all these people do that are working down there to get back to the food services, to the post office, to all of the services that are available on Southeast 82nd? It takes them a minute, 2 minutes, depending on where they start from, where they finish, to get back up on 82nd Avenue. And so what you've just heard, this easy ingress and egress, it's going to disappear. I realize this is not the time and the place to discuss the merits of this project, but it is time to state publicly that as an owner and representing the other owners in the Lawnfield Industrial Association, that we are being sacrificed by ODOT. ODOT's planned closing of the Lawnfield crossing without adequate connections to the fire, life, safety, and business services for an extended period of time is a huge problem, a problem that will put financial pressures on all of our businesses just when we're starting to recover from this extended downturn. You know, as you have heard, ODOT has passed along to Clackamas County the responsibility of designing and eventually constructing this new overpass to reconnect our businesses back up to 82nd Street. The concept is good, but the support is, we have not seen firm support from ODOT to Clackamas. We just heard earlier today that they've agreed to fund, but it's a concept only at this point. I don't believe there's any actual funding or assurances that the funds for the design, let alone for the construction, are in place. So that's a major problem for us. And, you know, depending on who speaks, just recently we were told from ODOT that the closure time between the time that they open up the Talbert overpass and they close the crossing of Longfield Road could be as little as 6 months. Today we heard from ODOT that it might be a year, and we have had discussions with Clackamas County, and they have told us to our face, year to 2 years is more realistic. So this becomes a problem. Longfield closing is a very serious problem, so serious that our association is now prepared to hire a professional traffic engineering firm to help us determine the financial impact that will affect our businesses. Today, our association collective experience with time and travel studies tells us that the estimated damages will exceed $500,000 annually while we wait for the opening of the Talbert overpass. I will finish by saying that I have actually been involved with ODOT since 1993-94 when they first started talking about this. And this Talbert overpass is not a new issue. Open for discussion or questions.
Any questions or comments? Representative Kennemer.
Yeah, mine probably is more in the nature of a comment. I hope that leadership will exert some direction in bringing parties together on this. And just a little bit of personal history, which is a little bit antagonistic, is I voted for the full funding of the Sunrise Corridor when I served in the Senate twice, in 1989 and 1993, and that money went to Bend. I'm very concerned about keeping the money that we have scheduled here, but my goodness, this project was funded a long time ago. And we need to keep those commitments. There are a lot of people in that area that built substantial businesses assuming that they were going to have adequate transportation. And that's not been what's been delivered.
Other questions, comments? Okay, this is just a public hearing today, so we will be coming back and communicating with all parties involved about where we go next. So thank you very much for coming out and for sharing your perspective.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and including Representative Fagan.
That would be fantastic. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
So we're going to carry over House Bill 3513 and till May 22nd, and we'll be opening a hearing on House Bill 3529. Representative Jensen, did you want to say a few words about that?
And members of the committee, House Bill 3529 directs Road Authority to dispose of any dead animal carcass that Road Authority finds on highway located in area of known wolf activity. It creates offense of failure to properly dispose of animal carcass and punishes by maximum fine of $500.
Thank you.
Get the record together, so I missed the announcement.
I know.
Switch that up.
You're going to get me confused before I get started.
People confuse myself and Representative Garrett a lot. We look so much alike.
Yes, you do. I mean, it's amazing.
Oh, both nice people. How's that?
Thank you, Chair Hoyle and members of the committee. I hope let me back up. I see staff is telling me that I haven't followed the appropriate protocol here. My name is Bob Jensen. I'm state representative from House District 58. For those of you unfortunate enough to not know where House District 58 is, it's in the northeastern part of the state. As a matter of fact, it begins at about Pendleton and runs to the Snake River, the border between Oregon and Idaho. The genesis of this bill came out of a trip that we made with Senator Hansel of from my, the senator from my district, and Senator Dingfelder, when we went up to Bilal County to look into the wolf issues and wolf problems that exist there. I hope that the committee takes this bill seriously. The speaker, when she took the first look at it before the first reading, says, is this a joke, or is this just a placeholder for something? Let me assure you that it is not the intention of it being a placeholder for anything other than what it stated in the bill, and further assure you that it is not, it's not come as a joke. Those of you who are not familiar with that part of the state and with one of public enemy number one in that part of the state, the gray wolf, you know, will have a short introductory course in that here. The gray wolf was virtually extinct there and began to be reintroduced a number of years ago. Actually, the first one to come in to the state swam across the Snake River, found it to be unoccupied by a lot of other wolves, and the hunting was pretty good, and decided to stay, and others have subsequently followed the path of that and other other efforts to repopulate the area with wolves. One of the things about the uniqueness of this animal is the incredible sense of smell that they have. An incredible sense of smell. It staggers me when I hear, you know, sometimes the stories about the wolf and its sense of smell. The first wolf to come into the state, the game biologist, wolf biologist, tell me that any wolf in Idaho that came across that track anywhere from the Idaho side on, as long as 2 years later, could pick up that smell of that wolf and follow it across the Snake River to the Oregon side and pick it up again there and follow it as it wandered back and forth through the Wallowa Mountains and the range over there. So this bill comes into context because, A, we have introduced this extremely efficient natural predator, and because it represents a major problem for the agricultural people, particularly the stockmen in that area. Wolves have, from the beginning of the introduction of cattle, taken a fond attachment to prime rib and some of those types of things, and they've been a very efficient hunter and predator. One of the things that wolves do is they, for a long ways off, if the wind's in the right direction, they can pick up the odor of a animal, and especially a dead animal, but they can pick that up and they will follow that scent of smell for long distances just to get to a food supply. As a consequence, when the wolf plan was being put together, there were provisions in there for taking of wolves, provisions that are currently held up in the courts, another story, but the thing that was required after the thing that was required of ranchers before they could get any compensation for a wolf kill. One of the things was required is they had to remove all of the bone piles that were on their property. And if they did that along with a number of other non-lethal means of control, then they would be potentially eligible for compensation. Not a small chore in and of itself, but then the loss of a good cow with pregnant with a calf is a substantial loss too. So the ranchers were a little disturbed when we were over there because the Department of ODOT, Oregon Department of Transportation, had been picking up roadkill, particularly deer, elk, and larger animals, and taking it out and dumping it in a place that would be identified as a bone pile. As a consequence, because that bone pile was located on what has become known as the Wolf Highway and what is used as habitat for the, or grazing ground for some of the cattle industry there, that pile of bones will attract wolves from all over in the MNAHA range or area, attack wolves from all over into where the cattle are being grazed. They were particularly grieved, I think, when they thought they had taken all of the steps that were necessary to live with this animal and were having something that was of no doing of theirs come along and interfere with their livestock and, take or kill some of the livestock. And this happens to be one of the most heavily killed, poor wording here, areas of the wolf depredation that's taking place in eastern Oregon. This is the real center of where a lot of that is taking place. So, at any rate, it was my sense or my feeling that something had to be done. I came back and submitted this bill for drafting, talked to the Department of Transportation of that, and told them what I was going to do and told them about the situation to their credit, and I will be eternally grateful for this. They acted promptly, quickly, to try to get a handle on this and at least in this particular area find another source, which was there fairly easy to do, that they could dispose of some of these carcasses. So it's not an axe to grind today with the Department of Transportation. I mean, they've responded very, very well to it, and I really appreciate that. But it is a matter of the liability of being born a human, we're all not going to be here forever. And the same way as the same people who are running and managing ODOT at the present time are going to come and go, too. And one thing about if it's in statute, future legislature can change it. But they have to do it deliberately, And as a consequence, people have an opportunity to become educated and informed on it. I think, and this remains for others to spell out for you, But I think the ODOT will have a kind of proposal that they'll be looking at, and I believe that it's safe for me to say from the brief conversations that I've had with them after they describe it, I think it's something that will be satisfactory with me. But I'd like for them to have the opportunity to present it before. But I would be happy to go to page two of the Wolf story, if you so desire.
Perfect. Any questions from the committee? If not, thank you very much. And we will call up Anne Haynes from the Association of Counties and Craig Honeyman from League of Oregon Cities.
Chair Hoyle, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Ann Hannes. I'm with the Association of Oregon County. The purpose of this bill is to make sure that carcasses are disposed of properly and to quickly minimize problems where wolves are active. This is a problem, especially in Northeast Oregon, where the wolf population has been increasing and ranchers are dealing with predation of their herds. Carcasses and bone piles can cause conflicts by attracting wolves. Figuring out the best procedures for disposing of carcasses is complicated by locating the appropriate places for disposal and by dwindling numbers of county road crews. Road emergencies and workloads can make it difficult to respond quickly to pick up and dispose of them. This bill could potentially apply to a large area of the state because it references both known and potential wolf activity, and it also focuses on the individual employee rather than the organization. But we believe this bill highlights a significant issue in eastern Oregon that can be resolved by focusing on the areas in the state most likely to be affected by high wolf activity. We suggest that an interim work group be formed consisting of city, county, and state road officials and Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife to determine best practices to dispose of carcasses quickly at appropriate sites. And AOC would be willing to help facilitate these meetings to develop solutions that would be effective and targeted. And we'd form the work group during the interim and report back by the February session. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you. Sir.
Vice Chair Hoyle, members of the committee, my name is Craig Honeyman with the League of Oregon Cities. Appreciate the opportunity to speak this afternoon on 3529. Basically, I'd like to associate myself with Ms. Hannes's remarks, and in doing so, Representative Jensen, express our respect for your concern about the impact that the wolves are having on cattlemen and ranchers, not only in your district, but throughout rural Oregon. Our concerns are that the bill describes the onus, if you put some of the onus, if you will, on a road authority. Cities are defined as being a road authority. Regulations will determine the areas of known wolf activity that are described in the bill, thereby restricting the impact of this bill to more rural communities. But the fact of the matter is smaller cities in the state may not have the staff to regularly and comprehensively patrol for and locate all of these carcasses. We also have a little bit of a concern with the enforcement provisions in the bill. Not sure that it should be individuals, but rather or the employee or the supervisor, as is stated in the bill, that is subject to the fine. And I'm liable to get skewered by my members for saying this, but it should be the institution, perhaps the cities, that are subject to the fine, not the individuals. A quick survey of some that I did this morning of some smaller rural cities indicates that they currently are as diligent as they can be in taking care of dead animal carcasses and disposing of them promptly. Some even pick them up in citizens or in private yards. Let me close by saying we would absolutely agree, cities would absolutely agree to participate in the aforementioned work group that Ms. Hannes described. And develop a best practices information on how to deal with this problem involving cities, counties, ODOT, ODF&W, and all the other stakeholder groups that may be necessary. So we'd be absolutely a party to that if that was agreeable. and I appreciate the opportunity to testify.
Any questions from the committee? Representative Berger.
Less a question than a comment. I appreciate that this bill may not spell out exactly who and how, and that is an issue, but I think you'll agree that where roadkill is unattractive and a problem in some areas, it is a dangerous problem if it attracts these predators, particularly to these small towns where you sure don't want those animals near the any population base at all. So I appreciate the discussion that the representative brought to this, because this isn't roadkill. This is dangerous roadkill if it attracts these predators.
Chair Hoyle, Representative Berger, we absolutely agree with that. This is a serious issue, particularly in eastern Oregon.
Where populations might just walk into a... Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you very much. I have two more people to testify on this bill, Paul Mather and Kurt Melcher, and we also have another bill to be heard, so keep it moving along. That'd be great.
Madam Chair, member of the committee, Paul Mather, Highway Division Minister for ODOT, and I will be brief. As Representative Jensen described, this issue was brought to us a few months ago in Wallowa County, and fortunately we were able to find a good solution in Wallowa County, and appreciate the representative bringing that to us and able to work that out. But that was unique to the opportunities and circumstances we had in Wallowa County as we look to put in statute those practices across the state. This bill would put a would dramatically change the way we deal with roadkill. I agree with Representative Berger's comment as well. This is something that we take very seriously, but again, it's in the details of the nuances of the bill that we have some concern. We support the idea of working this issue during the interim and try to work through some of the specifics as we deal with this this issue. Again, some of the things that have already been highlighted that we would highlight too, as far as just clarifying maybe the size of animal that we're dealing with. In the bill it says all animals. Some are likely more of a concern than others. We also have a concern as our employees are out there responding to accidents, plowing snow, doing other emergency response. This bill doesn't clarify what kind of trumps or takes priority in those situations. So we'd want to work through that issue. And just also support that the agency is the one that should be responsible. We have issues to or ways to deal with performance issues within the department, and would like to kind of leave it at that and make the agency responsible for meeting any requirements in the bill. So with that, I just stop and be open to any questions.
Questions? Okay. Representative Hicks.
If you do a work group, could you also contemplate what to do if the animal is not yet dead, but well on its way? I mean, incapacitated, it's lying by the side of the road, it's bleeding, a wolf could get it, but it's not dead. Someone then come up and coup de grace. I mean, could you work on that too? That's my request.
Chair Hoyle, Representative Hick, that's something that we can consider. That's obviously a difficult situation for employees when they come across animals, especially large animals, that are injured in some way, and how to deal with those. Typically, our ways of dealing with that now is to call in law enforcement. Yeah. And have them, you know, take the appropriate action. But that's something we'd have to deal with.
Madam Chair, Yes. Mr. Mather, you're proposing limiting the application of this provision to Wallowa County. Is that the only county that's affected by this problem?
Chair Hoyle, Representative Denbrough, ODF and W will probably talk more about the full scope of this. The reason we suggested that is because we had worked out this agreement with Representative Jensen and more of the idea of a pilot if we wanted to kind of start this. That was an area we already had some of these details worked out and how they would apply with to Wallowa County. And some of the unique circumstances in Wallowa County aren't applicable in other counties or other parts of the state. So that was our only one of our suggestions is to do that. But we understand the problem is much bigger than Wallowa County.
Yourself.
Thank you.
Chair Hoyle, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kurt Melcher, Deputy Director of the Department of Fish and Wildlife. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today and talk about House Bill 3529. I did want to also respond to, before I go into my testimony here, I did want to respond to Representative Hicks's questions about dispatching injured animals. Certainly, we do use enforcement officers to do that many times. However, any citizen, there's coverage in the law for any citizen that they can dispatch a wounded animal as well and not face any legal challenges. So our employees do routinely dispatch of animals when they receive a call, and I don't know that ODOT's employees do, but our employees do as well as the state police. So with that, Madam Chair, I just wanted to point out, and we're happy to participate in any work group if there's a work group in the interim. If not, we would want to work with Representative Jensen on a few little minor additions to this bill and this language. I think Mr. Mather pointed out clarifying which animals this applies to. Certainly, there's roadkill. I mean, I drive my 35 miles here every day, and I look at all the roadkill, and most of them are very small animals, which I think are probably not wolf attractants. So I think that's an important clarification. And then we do the things that this bill asks us to do, we largely do already. So it doesn't have any necessarily fiscal impact. We already identify the home range of our wolf packs. We know the areas of depredating wolves. We know the areas of potential wolf activity. I would say, however, the area of potential wolf activity would probably be quite large. It encompasses certainly the entire northeast Oregon corner of the state, the Baker, Union, Umatilla, as well as Wallowa counties, and probably Grant County as well. And then, of course, we have all seen our famous wandering wolf that brings into the question, is that a potential wolf activity county, any place where that wolf has been? So I think the potential wolf activity county could be quite broad, certainly broader than just Wallowa County. And then the other thing is that while we do these things, while we do certainly work with individuals on disposing of carcasses, we certainly do work with wolves and delineating their home range and their activity areas, we don't put those in rule. And certainly rulemaking is something that our commission does. It's quite cumbersome with public notification requirements, et cetera. And we're learning a lot about wolves. Their population is expanding. We would prefer to not have that, the area of known wolf activity in rule, simply because it's changing in many cases monthly or even more frequently than that. So with that, I will end my brief comments and happy to answer any questions.
Any questions at all? Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a few comments about the wolf activity. And Mr. Melcher mentioned it just at the close of his. I think it's almost all of eastern Oregon where the wolf activity will be at. It happens to be greater in Wallowa County probably than any other part of the state. But there's part of Wallowa County where there's still wolf activity that is not part of that, what we call the MNAHA pack. There are a couple of packs up in there, I think, that have and can be identified. And in fact, Umatilla County, which is not one that was mentioned, but I think Umatilla County is one where the agency was able to take down a couple of wolves, or a wolf, I'm not sure that I remember, in order to deal with the problem before it got more severe than it might have grown to. The issue of the size of the animal, that didn't really come up as an issue or question, as far as I was concerned. Kind of the country boy sort of attitude on these things. A chipmunk probably doesn't qualify as something that we would be that concerned about. and we could go through a whole variety of smaller animals. There is one small animal, however, that Representative Berger made an excellent point about that wasn't mentioned, and that's a skunk, the issue of safety. I've seen an awful lot of people take the ditch to avoid hitting a skunk, and that's with very good reason. If you want to throw safety in, why, that might be one you want to leave in as a not necessarily one that will endear us to the people who will be responsible for taking care of them of the kill. But I would think you know that we should be able to come up with a reasonable size, that something that is likely to be attractive to a predator, and I realize that wolves will eat rabbits and anything that you know just happens to be convenient. But the ones that it's both a you know, those animals will be consumed almost immediately by the predators, and there'll be more predators than just wolves in their case. So I'm glad. The one thing I did have a problem in writing the bill, the one thing I had to stop and think about carefully, and that was what to do with the carcass once they picked it up. And that's one of the questions and the issues that has arisen. Now, you know, first off, being on Ways and Means and looking for the most efficient ways to do things, it seemed logical that if we could go to a one-shop, one-stop shopping type of thing, so that the person, the agency, ODOT, that picks up the critter then would be responsible for it. Because the other thought I had would be for them to take it down to the local ODF&W headquarters or agent in that area and leave it there for the ODF&W. And so I had a little fun playing, you know, wondering how I could use that to some advantage in getting something on this bill. But I appreciate that. And you know, I can't say enough good things about both departments and my respect for the work that they do. And I'm sure that they will, you know, be very willing and very interested in addressing this problem in the most efficient way that we can. And if it's putting together a work group of some sort, we can do that. We can do it formally by amending the bill, or we can do it informally. You know, my trust level with the agencies is high enough that I think you know. I think you trust me well enough to know that if you didn't do it, I'd sure be screaming when we got back here. So I recognize that it's a little bit of a problem there, and I'd like to do the thing that would lead to the best solution for the state of Oregon. And I thank you for your ideas and thoughts and your willingness to work with us on that.
Further questions or comments? Yes, Representative Holby.
Thank you. This is a question for ODF&W. So I'm listening to this and trying to figure out what the solution is, because it appears that we're identifying several counties in Northeast Oregon that are areas of wolf activity and certainly potentially could become wolf activity. So is it the aim that carcasses wouldn't be able to be disposed of in those counties? Is that what you're anticipating? Is shipping these even out of county?
Yeah. Vice Chair Hicks and Representative Holvey, I think in many counties the landfills will take animal carcasses. In some facilities do not. And I think that's maybe one of the most important things that we would have to resolve in any work group is what are the options for legal disposal? How much does it cost? You know, what's the distances needed to travel? the general idea in as Representative Jensen mentioned, in the private cattle operations, we've been working with them for the last several years to essentially take their bone piles and their carcasses and generally bury them. I mean, if they're not going to take them to a landfill, that they bury them, and then they do not become an attractive nuisance, one that draws wolves into their area and then just exacerbates any problems we have with wolf-human, wolf-livestock conflict. So, you know, certainly the ideal situation is carcasses are buried or taken to an approved landfill. Short of that, there may be opportunities to dispose of them in some non-formal landfill areas, and there may be private properties that would take a carcass, but I don't know, and there's other agencies that know the legality of disposing of carcasses, things that I don't know.
And follow up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just curious where does ODFNW or ODOT, for that matter, currently in this area? I mean, I think Representative Jensen mentioned a bone pile where they currently take these carcasses. Is that located next to a private ranching facility or next to private property, or where exactly? What are they doing now?
Yeah, I'd have to defer to ODOT on that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, our current practice in Wallowa County before we engage with Representative Jensen was to take the carcasses to one of our what we call stockpile sites that are near the highway. We stage rock and other activities and just take them there and leave them there, and that was what he was referring to as the bone pile. Since then, we've changed that practice in Wallowa County. We now take them to the landfill. Statewide, our practices vary, depend on the opportunities. Obviously, if you're in a residential area, it's a very different practice than if you're in a very rural area. If you're in the rural areas, typically we just pull them off the road so they're not a road hazard and out of sight for the public, and then leave them there. But in these wolf habitat areas, that would be a problem. We'd have to pick these up and take them to an approved location. The numbers that we have as we compile, as we did research on this, would surprise you. I don't have them in front of me, but they're very large number of roadkill that we have to deal with on a daily basis, and there's a lot that's unreported. Just our reports is a fairly high number. So you extrapolate those with these requirements, and you get to some pretty big responsibilities that would be on the hands of our crews.
Representative Jensen.
Yeah, I think, Representative, in Wallowa County, they've already worked out an agreement that the ranchers see something like that out there could pick it up and take it into the county or enterprise. I don't know if it's the county or is it the county, Kurt?
Yeah, I believe so.
To the county landfill, and that you could dump it there. Now, because we haven't had this issue, this basically is something new. We haven't had the issue, and Wallowa County comes up as the focal point because that's where most of the wolf kills have taken place in the state. And I believe that's correct, Kurt.
Absolutely.
And it just happens to have been the place where the representative and two senators were at when the information was revealed to them. Otherwise, it could be Grant County, maybe, that we're talking about. But it's going to take some adjustments on other people's parts as well as just the two agencies here, counties, cities, are probably going to need to be, and as the cities were chiming in on this, it's very much a part of something they're going to have to be considered about. So in that sense, it makes good sense for us to do a work plan, a study, or something to come up with probably a little more doable than the legislator's initial idea.
Further questions or comments? There being none, thank you, gentlemen. And that is our, that's the end of our witness list for that. So I close the public hearing on House Bill 3529, and I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 3528.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3528 exempts registered lobbyists from reporting to Oregon Government Ethics Commission on money spent on lobbying other registered lobbyists.
Paul Cosgrove and Ron Burson. And Ron Burson. Not here. Okay. Oh, there he is. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Paul Cosgrove here representing as an officer of the Capital Club. I'm just going to briefly set the stage of why this bill is in front of you, and then there are others who are going to fill in the details. And with no disrespect to Mr. Burson, as soon as I finish testimony, I need to leave. I'm late to a different place that I need to be at. The Capital Club spends a good deal of effort, both its officers and its members, dealing with professionalism and training our folks on appropriate compliance with government ethics laws and our own standards of professional conduct. And over the years, we have worked with the Commission to make sure that we are instructing people consistently with what those requirements are. This bill came to you because of the following scenario. One of our registered lobbyists, a long-term lobbyist, had a client who was spending enough time in the building working with you on whatever issue they were working on that they felt they needed to register themselves as a lobbyist, not just as a lobbyist employer. And all of us have lobbyists we register and then our employers also register. That person raised a question about the fact that what expenditures needed to be reported. And as you may know, on a quarterly basis, we report as lobbyists what we have spent for the on lobbying for food, refreshments, and entertainment. Our employers report on a quarterly basis what they have spent in total on lobbying, not including personal lodging for us or any transportation. So the question was whether this particular expenditure would need to be reported on the lobbyist's quarterly report and or on the employer's quarterly report. And the expenditure was lobbyist is meeting with employer. They are discussing their bill, whatever bill that was, talking about strategy. And it was over a meal, and the employer paid for the lobbyist's meal. Does that have to be reported? And the answer that came back, first orally, and then we went ahead and asked for a staff opinion to confirm it, is that in the Commission's view, or in the Commission staff's view, the expenditures that lobbyists make when they are with their employers discussing lobbying matters need to be reported, as well as, we later clarified, the expenditures that UCS all making in the Capitol Cafe when we're buying lunch and talking to our colleagues about bills of interest, all those need to be reported as well. I did some surveying of our members, and when I talk about our members, recall that the members of the Capital Club include labor and government and business and NGOs and everybody else in between, 400 and odd different individuals. And to a person, no one had understood that that was reportable expenditures. We certainly understand expenses incurred when we are in your presence lobbying, or in the presence of an executive official, the governor, or a member of one of the departments lobbying for action on a legislative matter. But we certainly did not expect that and understand that expenditures while we are talking amongst ourselves needed to be reported. So we appreciate the committee bringing this bill for us to clarify this issue. If you take a look quickly at what the bill does, if you look on page one at lines 8 and 9, it says this is about the quarterly report that the lobbyist must send in. It says we must report the total amount of all monies expended for food, refreshments, and entertainment by the lobbyist for the purpose of lobbying. And we are proposing to exclude from that monies expended on lobbying another lobbyist who is registered with a commission or required to register with a commission, or the employer. That next phrase, or on lobbying any person on whose behalf a lobbyist is registered, that is the wording for a lobbyist employer. And then Section 2 of the bill starting at the bottom of the page and continuing to the top, has a very similar phrase and a very similar proposed exception. And this has to do with reports by our employers. And again, on lines 1 and 2 and page 2, it says that our employers have to report on a quarterly basis the total amount of all monies expended for lobbying activities, excluding living and travel expenses incurred for a lobbyist performing lobbying services. And we have the similar kind of exemption that does not need to include the expenses that were paid for a lobbyist to lobby another lobbyist. Just in closing, I would just point out that when we first heard of this problem, I made sort of a, maybe it isn't a cute comment, but it occurred to me that essentially almost everything that occurs in the Capitol Cafe fits the definition of lobbying, and if all those expenses needed to be reported, that we might just take the daily receipts of the cafe and allocate it pro rata on all our reports, because that's pretty much what happens in the Capitol Cafe. We're either talking to you as you come through or each other, and almost always it's about legislative matters of legislative interest. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions and would also ask if I can to be excused as soon as that part of the process is done.
Questions for Mr. Cosgrove? Seeing none, okay.
Thank you. I'm sorry to have to leave.
No problem. My name is Ron Burson, the Executive Director for the Oregon Government Ethics Commission. And I'd like to talk, first of all, I supplied the committee with some questions that were given to us on this subject that Mr. Cosgrove had talked about, on when is conversations, let's say, graduate to the level of lobbying, which would require the reporting of the expenditures that go about. And if you can see from this a specific example, as Mr. Cosgrove talked about, underneath hypothetical number 2 between a lobby and their client, the committee came back and answered no, that they did not believe that this that between the lobbyist and his or her client did not involve other persons. So I just want to go back to kind of the base of what the agency would look at on whether determining whether expenses need to be reported under current statute. And what we're going to do is we're actually going to look at the definition of lobbying, and we're going to find out if that what took place is lobbying. Under lobbying, under current statute, it talks means influencing or attempting to influence legislative action through oral or written communication with legislative officials. I think Mr. Cosgrove talked about that. He talks to you folks on a pretty regular basis. And then it goes on to say solicitation of executive official or other persons. And in that term solicitation, you'll see that the questions or the answers to the questions that we were given to us from Ms. Ray on whether or not these different scenarios were lobbying, you'll see that it kind of turns on that idea of solicitation, that simply two lobbyists talking to each other does not constitute lobbying. And so if it does not meet the definition of lobbying, we would not, as an agency, require those folks to include it on their expenditure report, their quarterly expenditure report. And as you can see, the majority of the answers that were given in these hypotheticals, the answer from the agency was no. Now to the bill. Just real quickly, this is a fundamental change on how the agency looks at lobbying and looks on who reports what expenditures in lobbying. In fact, the bill even goes to say in the first sentence, money expended on lobbying another lobbyist. So they're talking about actually lobbying. So it's, like I said, what we look at now is we would determine, are they lobbying? And then we would tie the expenses to that lobbying. This would be an exception to, yes, we're lobbying, but this is an exception to what would be reported. What I'd like to ask the committee to consider is that the agency in this biennium was able to secure through Ways and Means the funds for electronic reporting system. And in that electronic reporting system, we've been kind of trying to get this thing for about 6 years, is there's really an opportunity here to look at the lobby laws and look at what needs to be reported or what really the people that use our system. I mean, we're not talking about the lobbyists, we're not talking about the agency, we're talking about the public or the ones that come to us with this information and actually ask the question to these folks, what do they want to see? Do they want to see a cup of coffee from Cafe Today? I'm going to guess no, but I'm just guessing. Do they want to see casual conversations between lobbyists? Probably not. Do they want to see a lobbyist's own expenditures on themselves? Maybe not. But we haven't asked these questions. So that's why I would say I think with this reporting system, we have an opportunity to really kind of go to the base of what the commission does in providing this information to the public. And we're going to do it now instead of in a paper format that we've been doing since 1973. We're going to start doing it online where that information is available to people on a very regular basis. But the folks that really need to be brought into this conversation are the people that come to our agency and ask those questions. Like I say, when we make these kind of big fundamental changes, I think we got to bring all the players in and ask them the questions. So with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions from folks.
Okay, questions, Mr. Burson. Seeing none? Seeing none? This is the last chance, none? Okay, thank you, sir.
Thank you.
All right, Eileen Smith, John Chandler, and Jenna Ingram. And many, I think some members will probably have to leave at 5, which is fast approaching, so I ask our remaining witnesses to say your piece, but please do so efficiently.
That's the right way to say it.
Oh, okay. So Angie Dilks, please. And let's start with John Chandler.
Mr. Chair, members of the
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, I know. And say efficiently. I want to reemphasize that word.
Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builder Association here in support of House Bill 3528 in light of the hour and the fact that most of my testimony might otherwise be unprintable. I'll be very short. Never would have crossed my mind that I had to report conversations with another lobbyist. I've been a registered lobbyist ever since registration was required, I believe. We take our obligation, I certainly do, to report very seriously. I probably over-report. I have instructed my accountant and my association to do so. It wouldn't have crossed my mind that in conversation with my colleagues, professional colleagues, about legislation, which is what you end up talking about when you're dealing, particularly during a session, that we had to report. I'm not sure where the public interest is served by that. And just by one brief example, as Mr. Cosgrove mentioned, the people that support this bill come from all across the lobby, in-house, contract, labor, management, public sector, private sector. I'm an association lobbyist. I have a credit card I use for all association expenses. I pay for my own lunch if I eat here out of my own pocket. I'd have no way to report that. I never thought I had to. I maybe have been buying my own lunch when I didn't need to. That's good to know. But anything I do on that credit card gets automatically reported. That statement goes to the Ethics Commission. It goes to my accountant. That gets turned in on our quarterly reports. It's a very simple and, I think, easily documentable transactional process. To go beyond that, the sort of way that the opinion letter would have indicated, I think, is someplace between silly and really silly. So I'd encourage you to move this bill along. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have, but I do want you to please understand all of us in the lobby take our jobs very seriously as professionals. We take our obligations to report and our part in this process very seriously as well, and our obligation not only to our client but to the broader public interest is involved in the legislative process. Reporting is part of that. Silly reporting arguably would not be. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jenna Ingram, I guess I'm representing myself here today. I am the owner and principal of Court Street Consulting, located just a block and a half away from the Capitol Building. I have one full-time staff, two part-time staff, and we provide association management and lobbying for several 501c3 and C6 organizations. I've worked extensively on ethics legislation for the past 12 years, including Senate Bill 10, which represented a major overhaul of the ethics legislation. And those of you who are around then, I see you nodding, remembering how much fun it was. But never in the discussions were we geared toward anyone who was not considered a public official. The discussions, all of the task forces we had, the work groups, every single one for the past 12 years, we've always centered our focus on the relationship and the interaction between public officials, lobbyists and public officials, and never anyone who is not considered a public official. I just have a couple of very brief remarks because I too have another meeting up at Clackamas this evening. I really believe that this opinion would be unenforceable if it were allowed to stand. I was
going over, I went over it several times this past weekend, and noticed on page 2 where it says, it was based on the Attorney General's opinion on state employee lobbying, explains that employees would be soliciting others and therefore lobbying when meeting with stakeholders. Well, state employees are indeed public officials, and so it helps to make the point that the ethics statutes are focused on public officials and none other. I also believe it would be expensive, even under the electronic reporting, someone somewhere should be reviewing those reports. And I just think that this would be such a huge number of reports that would be sent to the Ethics Commission. I don't know how on earth they would monitor those unless they added just a whole lot of staff. And then one of the things that caught my eye when I read the bill, I almost think that the bill doesn't go far enough, because on page 1 of the opinion is talking about an individual approaches another person to lobby. I hope they mean a lobbyist, because at that point, if you're talking about an individual approaching another person to talk about legislation, let's be safe and say that the individual does mean a lobbyist. So when they're talking about other person, if they're going to apply it so broadly, does that mean if I, as a lobbyist, am leaning over the fence talking to one of my neighbors who's a farmer and saying, hey, there's a bill that's going to affect your water rights, and okay, I think it's a good idea if you come down and testify about that bill. So if we're going to apply it to non-public officials, then, I think my point is made. I won't take up any more time.
Are you? Tara Hicks, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Angie Dilks, and I'm here as an individual. I am a registered lobbyist as well. I volunteered to testify on this because in my situation, as I reviewed the information recently released, as some of you may be aware, my husband is also a registered lobbyist, and we do not work for the same entity. And so under the guidance that was released, quite honestly, I'm pretty sure a portion of my grocery bill and household expenses should probably be reported because, and you should feel sorry for my children when I make the following statement, we lobby one another on issues to try to get the other one involved all the time, over dinner often. Again, you should feel sorry for my kids at this point. But, I use a little bit of levity here to say that I think that, as John said, we all work really hard to be fully transparent on, we work hard to follow the laws that you all have put into place in terms of our registration. And I think that this opinion certainly caught us all by surprise, and I think it'd be really helpful to clarify the law. So I ask for your support for House Bill 3528.
Are there questions for any of these witnesses? I see none. Okay, thank you all. And next are Scott Winkles, Bruce Bishop, and Tricia Smith.
Is this the board?
Go ahead and start us off, Mr. Winkles.
Mr. Chair, a member of the committee, for the record, Scott Winkles, representing the League of Oregon Cities. I don't share Ms. Dilks' issues, but my wife is actually quite bored by what I do for a living, but I will be in trouble if I'm not at home in time for bath time, so I'll be brief. So the League of Oregon Cities is an ORS 190, which means it is an organization formed by other governments by agreement. And while the League lobbyists are registered lobbyists with the Ethics Commission, we are also public officials subject to that rubric as well as the lobbying rubric. And we actually take great pride in the fact that when we get our reports, we fill out reports quarterly, we have a whole bunch of zeros on them because we do not spend money generating, taking meals, going to meals. We are very cautious about how we use our members' money in the course of our duties and very careful about that. And I will also say that I was very much involved in Senate Bill 30 and Senate Bill 10, the ethics legislation. And again, it never occurred to anybody in that process that this was the interpretation of that statute. I think if that had been part of it, we would have addressed it back in 2009. I believe this legislation addresses something we were apparently remiss in. But I'll turn it over to my colleagues.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association, and I'm here also in support of House Bill 3528. Frankly, before
this bill came forward. I missed the opinion that started all of this discussion, and honestly, this had never occurred to me as something that we should be concerned about or something that needed some sort of government oversight. And I honestly think that for perhaps all the good reasons, this is an overreach by the commission. The point of the commission and the point of reporting, honestly, is to make sure that I am not unduly influencing you or your colleagues. If I am unduly influencing my lobby colleagues, good on me. I didn't realize I had to spend money on them to do it also until this bill came forward, and I think that that could be a bad problem, although I'm also thinking now that why aren't they spending money on me in order to get my support for their good ideas. But really, in all seriousness, the point of this, we need to remember what the point of the Ethics Commission is, and it's to make sure that there is no inappropriate behavior between lobbyists and elected officials. And this has nothing, whatever, to do with that. And so I think that this bill is very important to stop a serious overreach from this agency, and I hope you'll support it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Bruce Bishop, appearing on my own behalf and not on behalf of my employer or any other organization. I was president of the Capital Club in 2006 and 2007, and I will be brief. I'm here to support House Bill 3528. I do want to focus on one specific issue that was alluded to by Mr. Burson, and that's the question of whether my personal expenditures have to be reported if I'm engaged in lobbying. He suggested that that was an issue that he wanted to have a discussion with the public about, and it's my position that the law is pretty clear. I don't have to report my personal expenditures. I have never reported my personal expenditures, as today, for example, when I had lunch in the Capitol coffee shop before this hearing. I believe the law is clear that I don't have to, and if the Government Ethics Commission believes otherwise, that that's a reportable expenditure when I buy my own lunch and talk to somebody about supporting or opposing legislation, they have my contact information on file. I'll be glad to go talk with them about it. But it's not a reportable expenditure in my view, and I hope your actions will make it clear that we're not expected to report our own expenditures for just normal activities. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And questions for this set of witnesses? Okay, seeing none, well, thank you all. Any other witnesses at all on House Bill 3528? Oh. No, none? Okay. Closing the public hearing on House Bill 3528. Okay. And seeing no business before this committee, I adjourn the committee.